Good morning, good people. This is Kiplin Primus, your host for The Local Take on Jazz 91.9 WCLK. And this morning we're joined in the studio by Ms. Kim Ramsey White from Georgia State University School of Public Health. Kim, welcome.
Thank you so much, Primus. It's good to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here because I actually had a chance to see the exhibit at the Georgia State School of Law Library called Health is a Human Right. Can you share with our listeners exactly how that exhibit came to be?
Sure. Originally, the exhibit was on display at the David J. Censer CDC Museum at the Centers for Disease Control on Clifton Road. It was curated as to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the Office of Minority Health and Health Equity for the Centers for Disease Control. Dr. Leandris LeBird, who is the Associate Director for the Office of Minority Health and Health Equity, along with Ms. Louise Shaw, who was the curator from the CDC Museum, worked together with the Smithsonian Institute to actually come up with a way to commemorate or to document really more how race and marginalization and discrimination have impacted health across our nation, and how even though those are historical things, for the most part, they continue to plague us now. We still have the vestiges of those that are still keeping us from having the most optimal health in certain subpopulations of the country.
There were a lot of things that really surprised me about the exhibit, but you led me right to that subtitle, which was called Race and Place in America. And the exhibit is really about the 20th century, but it seemed like some of the things are still impacting the 21st century. So is race and place still a major impact on health for our communities today?
Absolutely. And in some instances, even more so. When we talk about race and place, particularly in the context of the exhibit shows how just African Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans have all suffered through, in many ways, about displacement. So being displaced from their natural environments, being away from and taken away from the ways in which they eat. Native Americans in particular in the exhibit, there's lots of information there about how Native American land was taken away and their water rights were taken away. And specifically in Arizona, to just create more lush golf courses. And in the what resulted from that was that Native populations were unable to grow the crops they were that they had been accustomed to growing. And so hence we have Native American populations have one of the highest rates of diabetes in the country. And the same thing goes across even for with African Americans and discrimination and segregation, particularly around housing segregation. And one of the things that we know in the 20th century that we've come to really understand is about how the social determinants of health impact how social determinants impact our health. So social determinants are, the easy way to remember them is it's where we live, it's where we work, it's where we go to school, it's where we play, and oftentimes it's where we pray. That comes into play as well. And so our environment, one of the biggest things when I started working on this exhibit, and I'm a faculty member in the School of Public Health and I teach in the area of health disparities. One of the most shocking things that came to me was that in this day and age, your zip code is a greater determination of your life expectancy than your biology or your genetics are. Where we live makes an absolute difference. Not having access to green space, not living in neighborhoods where sidewalks are safe, or even where the neighborhoods are safe. I teach a course, called Health Disparities and the Public's Health to mostly undergraduate students at Georgia State. And it's amazing how students are just, when you ask the question, you know, if people make a decision to sit on the couch and eat potato chips and not get out and walk, and then they have bad health, it's all their fault. Do you agree or disagree with that? And actually, I get about half the class goes either way. But the students who agree with that statement, I just did this the other day, and one young lady said to me, it doesn't make any sense. Even if you can't get out to the gym, you could take a walk in your neighborhood. You don't have to just sit there. So being able to share with her, well, one, how our neighborhoods got to be as segregated as they did, number one. Number two, because of policy, African-American neighborhoods, minority neighborhoods, not just having access to the green space and not having access to a place where your sidewalks aren't all broken up. So they don't ever think about that. We talked about food deserts and about not living in proximity to being able to have fresh fruits and vegetables. And I shared with them that in urban areas, a food desert is if you live more than 1 mile from fresh fruits and vegetables, you live in a food desert. And they said, what, 1 mile? You can walk 1 mile to the store. You got to be kidding me. And I said, okay, well, if you're a mom and you have five children and you're walking with milk and baby food, that's a very difficult thing to do. Well, that's not that bad. And see, in their minds, they catch an Uber. They have cars. And so our exhibit, I think, is really key to helping students to understand more about social determinants.
When you talk about access, even today, access is a challenge simply because of transportation. People may know that they need to get somewhere to take care of or manage their health, but they don't have a way to get there.
Absolutely. I had a student that did a project on immigrant or on refugee populations in Clarkston. And so when we start talking about refugee populations or populations of people who don't necessarily speak English as their first language, so having to find a provider that actually has a medically trained interpreter. So her study actually looked at how long it would take a person who lives in Clarkston to get to the closest medically trained interpreter for pediatric services, for OBGYN, for general care. And on using MARTA, one way to get to pediatric services could take you as long as an hour and a half on public transportation. So if you don't have no transportation at all, or even an hour and a half, think about how that interrupts your day in being able to get to a medical provider. So many times those things get in the way. And if you're not living it, too often it just doesn't make sense. We walk around and I say we, all of us in some way, shape, or form have a bias or a blinder that we can't see for things that don't necessarily impact our particular lives. But with students, it's even more so. They're younger, they're used to, you know, having things handed to them, well, not necessarily handed to them, but having access to things. And so helping them to better understand why these things are important is really critical. Being able to know that one of the things that we really stress is that health is in all policies, everything. I tell my students that I don't care what discipline you come from. If you leave my class and I haven't helped you to know and understand how your particular discipline impacts health, the health, your health, the health of your neighbors, then I haven't done my job. And that needs to be corrected.
I'm so glad that you are teaching that. One of the other things for me from the exhibit, especially in the health challenges faced by ethnic communities, is it seems like we're caught in this loop. In the mid-20th century Chicago schools and Chicago neighborhoods did not have access to clean water. Fast forward, and we know Flint, Michigan still doesn't have access to clean water. Are your students looking at some of these challenges that are personified in the exhibition as a way to, how do we get students, the new generation coming up, to address these things so that some person in the 22nd century isn't saying this city still doesn't have access to clean water.
Absolutely. I think I wish I had a really great answer for that. My answer for that, how I seek to try and change that is through education and is through ensuring the fact that students really get an opportunity to know and understand how racism, discrimination, marginalization, stigma, unequal access has the implications for health that it does. Teaching my class isn't necessarily an easy thing to do. We talk about things that are uncomfortable, and we talk, and not every faculty member is prepared to do that or feels comfortable doing that. I didn't feel comfortable doing it at first either, but I also recognized that the only way we were going to ever make a change is that this generation has to understand where it comes from. And so if we don't help them, if we don't give them the information, if we don't push them, they won't be able to go out and be able to make those kind of changes. I think that, and that's why thinking about health and thinking about it being in all policies, and I think one of the reasons why I really enjoy my class is that I have business majors in my class. So being able to help my business majors understand how income and economics impact health gives them an opportunity when they go out into the world and they get into their careers, prayerfully they will remember, oh, you know, well, maybe we don't have to do this way. Maybe we can do something a different way. I tell that to our neuroscience students as well. When we think about development and we think about, you know, children in Flint drinking water that has lead in it. So how do you as a neuroscientist, how are you going to do something about those kids in Flint that were impacted by that? And so for me, I'm not trying to simplify it by saying that, oh, education is the only answer. But for me and my approach to try and help curb these types of things from occurring is through education and being honest with my students and asking them to be honest with me.
I love the way that you are framing that all policy impacts health. But one of the other things about the exhibit that was wonderful to see was the various ethnic communities and the artwork are posters. So this is not necessarily considered artistic, but the posters that were promoting healthy outcomes from the Asian American community, the Latino community, and the posters from the Black Panther artists. Mm-hmm. Could you just talk a little bit about some of the art that is part of the exhibit?
Sure. So I think let's start with Emery Douglas's works. Emery Douglas was the illustrator for the Black Panther magazine. And we have 4 or 5 of his illustrations in the exhibit that in a lot of ways for my students, when they see these more positive images of the Black Panther Party actually taking care of their community, it gives them a whole different perspective. It counters that narrative of the Black Panthers only being this radical, violent organization. They have an opportunity to really see what community empowerment looked like through Emery Douglas's illustrations. We say all the time, right, cliche-ish as it may be, that a picture is worth 1,000 words. And that's one of the things that's so powerful about this exhibit. The illustrations, the photographs, there are a couple of photos that really, really stick out to me. One, there's a picture of the two women during World War II working on machines. Now, typically what we see are two white women working on machines, and we say they're the Rosie the Riveters. This exhibit shows two black females as Rosie the Riveters. Who would know that? Nobody would ever know that. That's not what our contemporary narrative tells us. That's not what we see. But for young people to have an opportunity to say, oh, yeah, well, black women, just as much as those black men were out fighting in World War II, there were black women who were also on those assembly lines trying to put things together. There's another photo there that's very poignant of an African-American man drinking out of a water fountain that says colored only. And I think about that, and we're probably two generations removed from that. And so that's not anything that young people are even hearing their parents talk about, like I did. My mother lived through segregation. I had an opportunity to hear firsthand what it was like for her traveling from New York to the South and not being able to use a particular restroom. But when these young people see a sign like that or see that as a poster, it gives you an opportunity to have a discussion about how things were. And simply because we're two generations removed, it's just not something that's, you know, even in their purview to see. You said also about the illustrations and pictures of Asian Americans and Latinos. And in a lot of ways, a lot of those illustrations show many of the horrendous things that happened to marginalized communities. There's a photo of a Mexican workers, male Mexican workers coming into the country. And again, this is during World War II. We needed people to be able to pick crops for us. And the picture is the man coming through with no shirt on and another person with a gas mask on spraying DDT on him to ensure the fact that he didn't bring any bugs into the United States. Now, of course, we all know what DDT has done. There, another one that my students even talked about and were really impressed, not impressed with, I think shocked, was a big picture about forced sterilization and the kind of eugenics that happened with the United States government wanting to weed out, you know, undesirable women and their children and actually holding benefits hostage if they weren't willing to actually participate in the sterilization.
And those laws didn't change until the mid-70s in a lot of states.
And what's the most poignant piece that comes out on that forced sterilization that's actually in the narrative on that photo is that the last state to disband it was Mississippi in 2008. And so, you know, that was really impactful for the students. They're like, what? That recently in my lifetime that has occurred?
So I'm amazed because I really did think it had mainly all stopped in the mid to late 70s. So for that to have still been on the books in 2008 is just an amazing thing.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the exhibit was curated for the 25th anniversary of the CDC Office of Minority Health.
Mm-hmm.
What do you hope for the exhibit in the future?
So if we could go back just a little bit. When the exhibit was originally in the museum, 2013 to 2014, it was there. And then when 2014 came, they took the exhibit down and it went into the basement of the CDC museum. From the very beginning, I knew that that exhibit had power. And because Georgia State University School of Public Health is an institution that focuses on, and the university as well, that focuses on urban issues and our School of Public Health specifically on health disparities, there was just always this kind of nudging, pulling at me that somehow or another, if we could get that exhibit, it would be an amazing teaching tool for our students. And so almost 3 years went by before I was able to get back to CDC. And they had never actually gifted an exhibit to a partner or a university before. Now, Emory and other universities actually have pieces from an exhibit, but to actually say, here's a whole exhibit, what can you do with it? It hadn't been done before. And it was a great partnership that we had with CDC. And I always feel really grateful. And I also feel a bit of a burden, if you will, about being entrusted and being the steward over something like that, because I know what power it has. So in January of last year, we worked with another curator from CDC Museum. Her name was Lori Cetesino. And Lori helped us. Now, what you saw at the exhibit, Kipling, is about a quarter of what there actually is in the exhibit. We didn't have enough space to actually replicate the entire exhibit. So there's probably another 10, 15 boxes of the exhibit that are still packed up that we're hoping to be able to utilize in the renovation space of the School of Public Health when we do that. But being able to have it up where it is in the law school, it gives us the opportunity for that exhibit to continue to have life, for that exhibit to actually have a legacy that didn't just stop in 2014, but is going to be able to move and to live on and to be able to use to be able to be used with students for many years. One of the things that we hope to do as far as our students are concerned is we have two faculty members now, Dr. Matt Gaiman in the School of he's in sociology, and Dr. Iris Feinberg in communications. Both of them will be piloting a curriculum in the spring of the year for their classes to actually use the exhibit as a teaching tool in their classes to help teach about public health communication and about racial and ethnic disparities. In addition to that, through a grant that our then librarist, Sharon Leslie, she has left Georgia State now and gone on to Emory. And honestly, without Sharon having written the grant that she wrote for us, I don't necessarily know that the exhibit would have gotten to the places where it did. But through Sharon's grant, we were able to curate an online exhibit that can be used around the country. Anybody can have access to it and be able to use it in their classrooms with their families. It's really so many. The internet gives us so many opportunities to be able to utilize this, and that's one of the things that we'll be able to do. The other one thing about the exhibit that I'm really very hopeful about is so the exhibit was curated in 2014, so we're almost 3 years later now. Other things have happened. So another way we can use the exhibit is we can use it as a tool with our students to say, okay, well, here's the last thing that's represented in this exhibit. What's happening now? If you had the opportunity to add to this exhibit more contemporary information, what would you do? How would you add it? And that's a great way to get students really hands-on into being able to think through how we solve some of these problems. And finally, there are two areas that are definitely not represented in the exhibit. One is disability. So we know that disparities exist across disability in race, in gender, and so many things. So there isn't really anything in the exhibit around disability. That's an area that is wide open for students to be able to contribute to. And the other one is in LGBTQ communities. We don't have anything in the exhibit about the disparities that occur in that population as well. And again, you know, we have those students on our campus. They are proud of who they are. They have a right to see their history represented as well. And it's also, again, another great opportunity to help students be informed about things that they, you know, things that people want to villainize. But once they get their hands in there and they start doing some work and they start meeting people, it makes such a difference in terms of how they go about their work and how they see the work that needs to be done.
You've mentioned so many things, Kim, but, you know, even the fact that the CDC did not start an office to speak to minority health and disparities until 25 years ago is even somewhat amazing. And I would be remiss if I did not remind our listeners that a lot of this exhibit started with the work and the writings of Clark Atlanta's own W.E.B. Du Bois.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's so exciting. He wrote an essay called, The Critique. Oh my gosh, I cannot. It would be right there and I could say it. But anyway, he wrote a paper about what it was like about why blacks were dying earlier. It was in 1904 that he wrote it. I can't believe I can't remember the name of it, but 1904 that he wrote this. And I also think that what we don't talk about, Du Bois did one of the first kind of epidemiological studies on blacks. And he looked at mortality rates and why blacks were dying. And it had nothing to do with inferiority. It had everything to do with lack of food, proper nutrition, and sanitation. These are all the same social determinants, you know, 100 years later that we're still trying to work through, that he was, that he identified in 1904. You look at what Du Bois did with Booker T. Washington in establishing the National Negro Health Week. That's really the movement that began to spur and get the United States and moved us forward. We had an Office of Negro Health earlier in the year, and then earlier in the century, and then around 1980 was when they established this Office of Minority Health, and really that also became the time when they started looking at other minorities' health and other subpopulations of health. You won't be able to go back and find a lot of data on Latinos and Hispanics and Asian Americans because they weren't collecting that data.
It is an amazing exhibit. And I know that it is open to the public. It's at the Georgia State University School of Law Library. It's open to the public. Could you share with our listeners how they can either come and see the exhibit or access the exhibit virtually online, which is beautiful, by the way?
Yep.
But share with our listeners how they can get involved with this.
Sure. So the exhibit is open to the public from 9 to 5, which are the regular business hours for the law school. It's not in the law library. It's on the fourth floor of the library, and you need just identification to come in, and I'm not even sure you need identification. I could get back and let you know for sure if that's what it is, but you just tell them that you're going up to see the exhibit, and you go up to the fourth floor. We have a map that will let you kind of know what's there so that it can be overwhelming. You could spend two and a half hours longer even if you really took your time and went through each piece of the exhibit. So we created a map so that people would kind of know what was there. And if there was something they were more interested in than something else, they could go directly to that. The online exhibit is available on the Georgia State Library webpage. I can give you the web address. It would be exhibit.library.gsu.edu. Exhibits with an S, exhibits.library.gsu.edu. That's access to the online platform of the exhibit, which actually has a little more in it. Not a little more, has a lot more in it than the actual physical exhibit does, because the online exhibit has the entire exhibit in it. I say the entire exhibit. The Emory Douglas pieces aren't in the online exhibit because at the time we didn't have the money to actually purchase the rights to utilize the his exhibits online. And actually, we only have the rights for 1 year for his exhibits in the physical, for his illustrations in the physical exhibit. We're hoping that as we, just look through up to this next year to maybe find some philanthropy, maybe find some other opportunities to raise monies to actually get more of the pieces that are copyrighted or that other people own, to be able to, adequately and appropriately compensate them for their work so that we can continue to use it in the exhibit. They're pieces that are powerful.
It is a very powerful exhibit. I hope everyone can go out to see it. And Kim, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to come and share with our listeners today about the Georgia State exhibit, Health is a Human Right. Thanks for listening to The Local Take on WCLK this morning. Special thanks to our guests for taking their time to speak with us. You can find many of these interviews posted online for on-demand listening at WCLK.com. If you want to recommend a community leader or nonprofit organization you would like to see featured on The Local Take, you can leave a voicemail on the WCLK Community Engagement Line at 404-880-6211, or you can email me at kiplinprimus@gmail.com. Good morning.